Hey, Chris and Evan here. Today's show, I talked to Trevor Bagnati about the latest draft board he did for Fear the Sword, about the different cast prospects and whatnot. Evan, we, though, have something to announce, a little thing we're going to be doing amid this hiatus. What exactly are we going to be doing?
Well, the way you let it off, I was hoping you'd let me announce that I finished my fossil collection in Animal Crossing.
You did do that, but you didn't get a reward, and that's a real bummer for everybody.
I got the satisfaction of now terrifying blathers with every bug donation I make going forward, so that's always fun. But the Locked On Cavs book club starting, everyone. And everyone just picture, like, party streamer noises and all that fun stuff, and maybe a couple sirens or something to scare the people who aren't really listening. But Chris, what book are we reading as a class?
So we are going to be reading Return of the King, LeBron James, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the Greatest Comeback in NBA History, written by Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin. This is a book about the 2016 title win, all that went into it. There's a lot of really great insights in there, just to give you little things in the back of the book in case you're unfamiliar. Quote, Brian Windhorst and Dave McMenamin are courtside and in the locker room for the most improbable comeback in NBA history. Through exhaustive, inclusive reporting, the duo have delivered an important, essential book for all NBA fans. That's from the great Jonathan Abrams. And then from Tracy McGrady, I've always admired Brian's acumen and his seasoned perspective. This story with Dave McMenamin of LeBron and the Cleveland Cavaliers' championship run is captivating and filled with spectacular detail. He's extremely right about that. This is a very, very good book. We're going to do for about 9 weeks. There's 18 chapters in this book starting the end of next week. So you got a little time to get it. I think you can get it at your library. You can get it from Hoopla. Many of you probably already have it when you bought this. What we're going to do is every Friday or the end of the week, whenever we kind of get around to it, we're going to talk through two chapters at a time. We'll slowly do this book club, kind of have it kind of do a slow burn on it and break it all down as we go through and kind of revisit this. Our friends over at the Chase Down office, they have a great series right now covering the 2016 finals, but we're going to do this book club on that. It's the book you guys, the listeners, voted on as compared to other options. So that's what we're going to do. And I think it's a really, really good book. I've read it once, maybe once and a half at this point. And it's a really, really great book. And I'm looking forward to diving into it.
I am too. And I expect everyone to email Chris their full reports for him to grade. Not me, just Chris. You can send it to the Lock On Cavs email. Just the book reports due on Chris's desk in 9 weeks' time. So thanks for everyone for voting. And hopefully you guys are having an okay quarantine period.
Yeah, so what we'll do again, we're going to start this. Well, there's actually 19 chapters, so we'll do about two a week. I miscounted earlier when I did this, and I'm realizing that now. 19 plus the epilogue plus an introduction that is from Richard Jefferson, the always hilarious Richard Jefferson. His intro has a really, really good kicker, actually. It's very heartfelt. Maybe the most heartfelt thing I've ever heard Richard say or do. So we're going to do this again over the next 9 weeks and break this book all the way down, just kind of diving into that season, diving into the stuff we learned from this book and a whole bunch of other stuff. So stay tuned for that. We have a bunch of other series coming on the Locked On Network. Later this week, we talked to friend of the program, Alex Hooper, formerly of 92.3, about the 2016-17 Cavs. Greg Schwartz is going to be on to talk about the 2008-09 Cavs and a whole bunch of other stuff. So that's going to be coming up, and we're going to do that book club starting next week. But without further ado, here's today's show with Trevor Bagnati talking about the NBA draft and his latest draft board, which you can go read right now over at fearthesword.com. Thanks for listening.
You are Locked On Cavaliers, your daily Cleveland Cavaliers podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Cleveland Cavaliers select Darius Garland from Vanderbilt University.
Cleveland! This is for you!
Trevor, what's going on, buddy? How are you doing as we get deeper and deeper into this quarantine?
Good. I kind of got kind of thrown off a little bit with draft prep, just with the uncertainty with everything. I was having a little bit of motivation trouble, but now I'm kind of back into things. Excited to talk about the new big board, because I've been able to grind through a good amount of tape here, and I think that opinions are changing on how we perceive some of the guys throughout the top of this draft, even though no games are playing, just because of the amount of time that we're able to devote to kind of really getting into the finer points of what's going to make these guys tick at the NBA level.
So, okay, before we get into your newest big board, the draft as we know it is likely going to get pushed into the summer. We have teams, I think the reporting is that some teams have asked for August. I don't think we'll get August, but I think it's going to go back to at least sometime in July. Trevor, when you think about this, and you wrote a really good piece about this at Fear the Sword, when you look at how this is going to affect the draft and the lead up to it and how we evaluate things, this, I think, will be the first kind of one of the first things we see really affected. And I'm certainly sure I don't know this. I haven't read a good piece about this yet, but I'm sure this has been the case with the WNBA draft, which is this week to some degree, which obviously it gets a little less focused than the NBA draft. But when you look at the draft and it being pushed back in that way, how do you just envision a draft that will take place sometime in July instead of June, or maybe does get pushed back into August? How do you think that will affect things and just kind of as you take a best guess at it right now?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see how, like, what teams are able to do if the draft gets pushed back, because as it stands right now, they're really only able to do like the virtual meetings and workouts. They've got limited access to be able to do that. They can only talk to prospects for a certain amount of time per week. And there's no in-person stuff. My question, if they do push the draft back, number one is there going to be a draft combine? Is there going to be some sort of group workout setting to some degree, even if it's just like college pro days, being able to do those in the lead up to the draft? Is that going to be something that is going to be able to happen if the draft gets pushed back? Because if that happens, I think it's going to be a lot more business as usual. I think it's going to be a little bit easier for teams to be able to scout, and you're going to add in that little bit of extra time that we've had here, and teams may be able to make some better informed decisions if they're able to have a more complete process in addition to this extra time scouting that they've had. But if that doesn't happen, I'm very interested to see how we find out who is actually doing the legwork in terms of film breakdown in these different scouting departments. I think that there's a conception here that it's going to mean that there's going to be a lot of sleepers, I think, taken in this draft, because there's going to be a lot of guys who aren't normally identified in the pre-draft process that are going to kind of fly under the radar, and we might have some guys down in the middle of the first round or down lower in the second round who may end up being, better players in this draft. I think that was always going to be the case for this year. I don't think that that necessarily changes anything. I think what's really going to be interesting for this draft is not so much the top. I think that's pretty much going to be staying the same. Teams are going to devote the same resources to that. I think what's really going to be impacted with this is going to be filling out things on the margins. I think this is going to be a second round that is going to see a lot of boom or bust. I think it's going to be a lot of guys who either never really get a chance to even get on the floor in the league, with a few guys who end up becoming valuable NBA rotation players sprinkled in, more so than your typical second round, which already is that to some degree, but you get some guys that kind of get like a cup of coffee, 2-3 years of playing, as teams like ninth, 10th man, and then they kind of phase out of the league. I think that guy is going to be a little bit harder to find this year, and we're going to see some mistakes made in the second round where there are going to be just some guys who are clearly not NBA talents picked up, and there are also going to be some clear first-round talents who end up falling to that point. So I think you're going to see much less of a deviation in the first round than is being anticipated, and a lot more difficulty identifying your typical second-round talents than what we're going to see. I think we're going to end up seeing a lot of undrafted guys and end up finding NBA roles. And I think we're going to have a lot of second round guys who maybe are picked in like that 30 to 40 range that, you know, typically have a shot to still become good NBA players who just are completely phased out of the league 3 years from now.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me. I think the guys that are sort of more known quantities at this point are definitely going to be the ones kind of hurt more than anybody else, just because, you know, the guys, I think there are certain guys that you have, including guys on your board, that I think are sort of more known quantities. You know, guys that we have tape on, guys that teams have been scouting, that, you know, that teams went out to Australia, got to see LaMelo Ball play. They got to see RJ Hampton play. Like, they've gone and seen other guys play in college. Like, yeah, there's certainly guys that they didn't get to get to, and you didn't get as much tape on guys. And, you know, I wonder if this would lead a team to talk them at the top of the draft to, like, lean talking themselves easier into someone like Obi Toppin or James Wiseman or guys that sort of fit, like, sort of traditional archetypes and have sort of things you sort of expect them to do, and then are a little guys that are a little less, let's say, risky just in the terms of how these teams are evaluating them. I'll be curious to see sort of how that happens, especially in a draft, Trevor, that you have talked about that. A lot of people have indicated, you know, isn't a draft that is as high of quality as we see in other years.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see kind of how some of these guys who are, you know, are atypical draft prospects in a given year are going to be evaluated too. You know, you mentioned the two guys you mentioned there, LaMelo Ball and James Wiseman. Those are not typical cases. You know, you do not typically have a guy who plays three college games and then is done for the year. You do not have a guy who opts to go play basketball overseas and then ends his overseas season early. And you know, while he's over there, is playing in a situation where, you know, he is by far the best player on that team. It's a really interesting situation to see it kind of those guys kind of be locked into, okay, these are the more like familiar players in this draft. They're among the more familiar faces, because in a typical year, those guys are not the guys that we know anything about. And they're the hardest guys to project. You know, I remember 2017, Terrence Ferguson was really difficult to project where he was going to go because he played in the NBL. It was hard to kind of gauge where he fit compared to other similar draft prospects in his range. Similarly, you've got guys who get injured midway through the year, like Nerlens Noel, I think is probably our closest comparison to James Wiseman. That was a really difficult guy to be able to gauge how healthy he was going to be. And, you know, he didn't end up playing that full season. Darius Bazley, another guy who kind of fits Wiseman's archetype of a guy who just didn't play basketball for a prolonged period of time before coming into the draft process. So, you know, it's interesting to see those guys be the guys that we're talking about and we're spending the most energy on right now, because those are the guys that we really don't know that much about. And, you know, it's interesting to see them be the ones who are graded as like, okay, these are kind of the guys that we would rate highly in this draft. Because in a typical year, they are the ones that are the hardest to evaluate. But because of the way that this class is as a whole, they're kind of propped up a little bit, and they're kind of on the easier end of the spectrum to evaluate, just because they are the few guys who have, you know, real NBA size in Wiseman's case, and, you know, real NBA skills in LaMelo Ball's case. And I think that it's easy to kind of see, you know, how they might translate compared to some of these other guys who are a little bit wonkier in terms of their fit at the next level.
What about someone like Toppin, as we wrap up our first segment here? But what about someone like Obi Toppin, who was a Naismith Player of the Year, comes in as sort of a scorer, sort of a guy that I think really kind of came on people's radar in the last several months, but sort of has made his – he already – before the tournament, he was one of those guys that, unlike maybe some of the other guys that probably would have liked to got some time in March, he sort of made the case for him being a player in the draft and someone the team should pay attention to. How do you think this will affect someone like him, this guy who is insanely productive and was like a very, very, very good college scorer?
Oh, it's a very good year for Obi Toppin to be coming into this draft. The guy that I compare him to most in terms of just kind of his fit among this class is Chris Dunn in 2016. Because when you have a class that's lower on that top end talent and is particularly low end on that top end freshman talent, guys who are productive that are older look better. And a guy like Toppin, who is putting up a ton of really good numbers consistently and has a few things that he's doing consistently well on the floor, look like better prospects in a vacuum than the guys who are, you know, maybe not doing things consistently, but are demonstrating real NBA skills. I mean, you compare, you know, Obi Toppin last year, I do not think we're having a conversation of him being a potential top five pick because, you know, there were clear guys, Jarrett Culver, RJ Barrett, Zion Williamson, John Morant, who were younger, had more potential, and had also shown some dominant play at the college level. This year, you really don't have that dominant play at the college level from those freshman guys. And that's how a guy like Toppin or a guy like Chris Dunn or a guy to a lesser extent like Otto Porter in 2013, that's how those guys end up going in the top five, is because they're the ones who were putting up the production and, you know, at least look the part of NBA players. You know, Dunn was a 6'4 point guard, Porter a 6'9 wing who had some potential good defensive skill. Toppin, ball handler who can play at 6'9, looks like he can function well as an athlete. You know, those guys end up looking a lot better, and then that hides a little bit of their weaknesses. I think it was Jonathan Wasserman of Bleacher Report the other day tweeted out, you know, the comparisons of guys who are projected as top 10 picks or have gone in the top 10 over the past decade at the age that Toppin is or older. And outside of Buddy Hield, it's a very dark list in terms of NBA outcomes. And I think teams are kind of getting themselves trapped in a position where, you know, comparative to the other players in this class, Toppin looks pretty good, but it's because he's an older prospect who's playing against younger guys and is more physically developed, more close to what his actual peak is going to be than, you know, a guy like Anthony Edwards or a guy like Onyeka Okongwu. And that can make those guys look better than they actually are when they translate to the NBA level.
The one thing I'll add but there is just with Hield, it's like that guy has a very – came in just sort of with that. It took a little bit to develop, obviously, but had a very modern NBA skill set in terms of the three-point shooting and stuff like that. So I think that's just sort of worth noting when you think about a guy like that. Okay, quick break. We'll be back with more here with Trevor on this episode of Locked On Cavs, and we'll finally reveal who the number one player on his new big board is. So stay tuned for that. If you're like me, you're probably starting to think about what to eat for dinner while you're eating lunch. I love food, and that's why I love using Postmates. They deliver food from every restaurant I can think of right to my door. They also don't just deliver burgers and sushi. They also make my life easier with grocery delivery and whatever I can think of delivery too. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for the first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app, that's the Postmates app, and use the promo code LOCKEDONNFL. That's promo code LOCKEDONNFL for $100 of free delivery credit with no minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. That's an app you can get anywhere on the Apple Store, if you have a Google Store, in the Google Store, anywhere you can get your apps, get that wonderful Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime, Postmate it. From an early morning breakfast burrito to a 12-pack of beers while you watch the game or watching a rerun of a game, considering we're in a quarantine right now, sometimes you just need what you need delivered fast, and that's where Postmates comes in. Again, get $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days with the promo code LOCKEDONNFL. All right, we're back here. Trevor, give us the new number one on your draft board. I don't believe that this guy was number one in your last one. I should have double-checked that. But you have a number one here, and I think it'll be surprising to some people.
Yeah, so this draft board, I moved Anthony Edwards out of the top slot for the first time since, I believe, my opening one of the year. Just kind of the more looking at it, the more I've kind of thought about it. Killian Hayes, who is the new number one guy in the class, just has a better chance of being an NBA player and being a quality NBA rotation player than Edwards does of becoming a star level player in the NBA. Edwards has much more bust potential than Killian Hayes does, just because of his decision making, because of some of the problems with his overall kind of shot selection demeanor, the way that he goes about being a number one option at the college level at Georgia. I think Killian Hayes has more development potential, potential that he could still become a star, but at the very least he's going to become a very good two-way rotation player in the NBA. And that's why I've moved him into the number one spot. I think he's your best shot at kind of becoming the guy that is probably one of the most valued spots on my draft board, which is the guy who is a good complementary wing at his floor and has enough skills that are developable that he can eventually become kind of that star level player, or at least all star level player. And he is the type that you really want to have for every aspect of your rebuild, because every part of his outcome ends up with a guy who's useful at the NBA level in a playoff rotation.
So when you think about him within the Cavs fit, here's kind of a line from your thing, quote, "Of all the point guards in this class, Hayes is probably the best fit for the Cavs to pursue thanks to his size at 6'6 and defensive versatility." So this is a 6'6 point guard, comes from overseas. Let's say the Cavs don't do anything and don't move off of Garland or Sexton going into next year. What is bringing in Killian Hayes to that group already, and what the Cavs have invested in that position already the last couple of years? And assuming, you know, I think Darius deserves some benefit of the doubt considering how little he played in college, and we'll see what he looks like in year two before we really, I think, get a little dicey about his long-term outlook. But what would introducing Hayes into that group sort of do? What do you think that kind of looks like?
Well, I think you, in the Cavs' perspective, you have to think of him less as a point guard and more of a playmaking wing. I think that Hayes has the skill set to be able to develop into that potential position, and a playmaking wing is definitely what this team needs, next to definitely Colin Sexton and probably Darius Garland as well. I really think the fit of Hayes next to Sexton is really good, because the guy who's going to make Sexton work, I think, the best is a guy who is able to handle distribution responsibility, is able to create for others on the floor, is able to play off ball when Sexton is the guy you're running your offense through, and is also able to defend multiple positions on the floor so that you can keep Sexton from having to be the only point of attack defender that you have on the floor. I think that you want a guy who's a tall creator next to somebody who's going to eat shots like Sexton. I think that is a good fit. I definitely think that Hayes is going to eventually be that type of player, and you can develop him into that role. Garland, I think the fit is a little bit more tricky, just because I don't know that Hayes is going to be the same type of off-ball player that you want next to Garland, where he can play as maybe like a true wing. But definitely, again, a guy who you have multiple guys on the floor there who have very good court vision, who have very good passing technique, can create for their teammates, are going to be able to get guys in open spots. And then, you know, you're going to be able to run pick and roll with multiple guys on the floor, which is something that the Cavs have lacked a little bit in the last couple of years. They don't have like that guy who can run like that secondary pick and roll off of the primary action as well. So Hayes would bring that. And then, you know, with Garland, the fit with Garland, it's all about Hayes' defensive potential, having a good off-ball defender who communicates well, who rotates well to be able to cover for him and his defensive deficiencies. So I really think of all of the guards in this draft, he's the guy who fits best with both of them. And then, you know, he can fit well with either of them moving forward if you decide to move off of one of those guys. If Hayes kind of gets himself to a point where, you know, he's a clear fit with one guy over the other.
So when you think about him in this class, and he's number one on your board, and here just so people have the top five, or the tier one, let's do it that way. LaMelo Ball is number two. Anthony Edwards, who we've talked about a bunch and I think sort of has been talked about the more than anyone in this class to a large degree, is number three. Onyeka Okongwu from USC is number four. And there's other guys like Cole Anthony, Denny Avdija at number five, Tyrese Maxey, et cetera, in tier two. how big of – this is a weird draft. I think everyone just sort of knows that. But when you think about putting Hayes at one, starter grade players, high variance upside is sort of what that tier looks like. When you think about him, what is the for you in terms of you thinking of the best option for the Cavs? How many degrees is he separated from guys like LaMelo, guys like Anthony Edwards?
Well, I think that if you're picking Hayes, you're picking a guy not so much for star power as you are for a guy who just fits the roster and a guy who just is going to make things click a little bit more with the guys that you already have on your team. And I think that he fits that role for a lot of different teams, better than guys like Edwards, guys like Ball. Ball, I think, is interesting because he kind of fits the similar spot, I think, where he is, I think, going to be a competent role player. And it's kind of, can he get the other parts of his game to work for him enough that he's able to get into that star level play? Because Ball's better than Hayes at quite a few things. He's better. He's a better passer, has better court vision. I think that he's a better finisher than Hayes is. And obviously he's got the extra benefit of being a little bit longer, a little bit more agile than Hayes is too. So there's, even though Hayes is a better technical defender at this point, there's a potential that Ball ends up better. I think the main thing that you're positioning Hayes above Ball for is just the fact that Hayes doesn't have, you know, the perceived extra baggage that Ball does. He doesn't have the jumper questions that Ball does. He doesn't have the off-court questions that Ball does. So I think that he's a little bit better of kind of more safe option than LaMelo is. And then with Edwards, it's just about, do you draft for pure star power, or do you draft the guy who's going to fit with the rest of your team? And I think that Ball just has Hayes just has a better chance of becoming the guy that you want him to be, especially for the Cavs, than Edwards does.
All right, we'll take a quick break, come back with more on this episode of Locked On Cavs, and get into the rest of Trevor's Big Board right after this. All right, we are back here with the one and only Trevor Magnotti on Twitter at Illegal Screens. Trevor, I'm going to let you pick here. Let's talk about, who else do you want to talk about on this big board? Who is just someone you want to spend a little time on today?
Well, looking at things, we should probably talk a little bit about my justification for the big dropper on my board, which is Isaac Okoro, was in my tier one on my last board and now is in tier three. I think I dropped him five spots to number 11.
Why? What is the you taking him down from that far, especially when you think about this being your Cavs sort of big board? He is, in your words, one of the best fits for the Cavs from a team building perspective. I would certainly imagine he's in play if they drop a little bit in the lottery, which obviously we know is sort of going to be possible. But even though they're at the second place if the season ended today in terms of the lottery odds. But why did he drop? What are the concerns there?
Well, I think the thing is, the more tape I've watched on Okoro, the more questions I have about his offensive value. It's always been the case that we've thought, okay, Okoro is this really good defensive prospect who, you know, just has to find a fit on the offensive end to be able to be successful. And I think that he has that fit if his defense is as good as advertised. And I think that my major revelation kind of over the last few weeks has been that his defense really isn't as good as I had initially thought. You know, the more I've watched him, the more you start to see cracks in the armor, the more you start to see kind of some off-ball lapses, the more you start to see him get bodied when he switched over on bigger wing guys who you would consider like bigger wings at the NBA level. So, you know, you're thinking the translation to him defending fours at the NBA level, to him potentially defending, you know, playmaking fives at the NBA level if his team is going to go small. I have more doubts about how well he's going to be able to handle those different situations. And if he's not like a generational type defender, you know, like the guys I've compared him to, like Draymond Green, like Marcus Smart initially, if he's not that type of guy, his offensive issues are kind of a non-starter for him, because if you don't have an elite guy who's an elite defender, then you can't play him for stretches because he doesn't bring enough on the offensive end to remain valuable, to be able to offset him not being like a top 15 defender in the league. So I think that's the main reason that I've dropped him, is because if he's not that guy, then he's going to be a guy who probably falls out of the league, just because he is so far behind as a shooter. He is so far behind as a playmaker with the ball in his hands. Even though he has flashes of that, I just don't think that he gets to a point, if he's not a top level defender, where he's simply a good defender and he's playable at the NBA level.
So when I think about this, when I think about Okoro and I think about him, the guy that comes to mind as sort of a comparison for a guy that is so clearly talented on defense but has these clear offensive limitations is Cam Reddish. Now, I don't necessarily believe those are fair, but just to run through what Reddish, you can tell me if that's wrong or not. But when I think about with what Reddish was, age 20 with Atlanta this year, in 58 games, 10.5 points, shot only 38.4% from the field, 33.2% from three, did shoot 80% on a pretty small amount of free throws per game, but really made some standout defensive plays. Like, there are some clips you can find of Cam Reddish that are just like, oh my God, this guy has just wild potential, and on the defensive end of the floor, and is just going to figure some of that out. Is that a... But he obviously has a long way to go in the offensive end before we can kind of consider him a really useful two-way player. Is that the sort of path for him on there? And kind of looking at some of the data for him, just look, he's, according to the, this is from the Rookie Wire, 0.7 points per possession while shooting off a catch. That's 19th percentile, and 11 of 45 on those looks, which is 24.4%. That's pretty bad. That's pretty concerning. But is that kind of Reddish angle sort of a reasonable thing to kind of box to put him in, or am I off there?
I think it's a little bit off, just because, like, Reddish, for all of his offensive woes this season, he at the very least was able to command a pretty significant volume for that Hawks team, particularly when some of their other guys who you would normally think of as creators, when those guys weren't hitting. I think the guy that there is a Hawks guy that I think you can compare him to, and I think it's more DeAndre Hunter.
Okay, cool, cool.
DeAndre Hunter, his volume was so low on the offensive end in terms of him just kind of doing stuff, that, you know, it really put the focus on his defense, and he was not the defensive prospect that he was billed as prior to the 19 draft. And I think that, you know, Okoro might find himself in a similar situation where, you know, you're thinking of him as this guy who, okay, he can do a couple things on offense. You can kind of keep his volume down, but he's going to bring you so many things on the defensive end that, you know, you can get by. And then, you know, you get into the regular season and it's, oh, damn, he really actually does not have it together on the defensive end as much as we thought he did. And he also cannot command any sort of consistent volume on the offensive end. We have to use him really sparingly, and suddenly that's a guy who is really taking away a lot of stuff and a lot of things that you can do when he's on the floor on both ends of the ball. And I think that is the issue with potentially drafting Isaac Okoro, is that, you know, he's going to be even more limited on both ends than you think. Whereas, like, a guy like Reddish, he may not be successful at what you want him to do, but he can at least go out there and do it. You know, it's more of a process thing than the results thing, where, you know, you can get him doing some of the things that you're eventually going to want him doing on the offensive end. He may fail. Whereas, you know, Hunter was not even at the level where you could start trusting him to do some of the things that you want him eventually doing when he's at his peak.
All right, Trevor, give me one more guy before that you want to touch on before we get out of here.
All right, I guess, do you want to talk about James Wiseman, or do you want to talk about?
I have a bit for that at the end here that I'm going to, like, end this podcast on. So we're going to work up to that. So give me somebody else.
All right, so let's talk about Devin Vassell, the guy who has kind of been rising up the board throughout this year.
Give me the lowdown on him. What's the deal?
So I think the main reason that he's growing throughout the year is like we kind of realized at the beginning of the year, oh, this is a guy who's like a really good 3-and-D prospect, had really good size, was playing a lot of four at the college level, but pretty easily translated to three when you considered how well his corner three had looked like it developed, how versatile he was on the defensive end, and the types of winning plays that he made. Like last year where we had, you know, Brandon Clark and we had Grant Williams. He is the guy this year more than anybody else who you can point to and say, yes, this is the guy who does all of the little stuff that is going to help him be on winning teams and create a winning atmosphere when he's on the floor. And then, you know, the more that we watched throughout the year, we saw kind of some glimpses of some of those things that we talked about with Killian Hayes, those skills that are going to be developable where, you know, maybe, okay, this guy might have an outside shot of being like a core rotation piece as opposed to just this really good rotation player. And that comes with kind of his pull-up shooting off of 1-2 dribbles, his creation ability with the ball in his hands, and then just continued kind of exploration of his versatility on the defensive end. Suddenly you've just got a guy, I think more than anything, Vassell is probably the second best guy behind Denny Avdija in terms of the question, who is the guy who does the most stuff well on the floor? Who has the most skills that you would put at like an acceptable to good level when you translate him to the NBA floor? May not have any elite skills, but at least does a lot of different things and doesn't have a ton of glaring weaknesses. I think that is what has put him firmly into my top 10. I have him at number 9 in this ranking when he started, I think, completely off my board to begin the year. I think he's just a guy who has very few weaknesses, has a few developable skills that you can maybe see translating to above average or even elite level at the NBA level. And I think he's just a guy who is going to be one of the more valuable players out of this class, regardless of where he's picked.
If the Cavs, let's say, fall to like the 6-7 range, he's an obvious pick for you. Assuming he's on the board, he's an obvious pick for you. Let's say the guys we sort of expect would be off the board, and Adija's off the board at like 7-8. Is he the obvious pick over a guy like RJ Hampton, over a guy like Tyrese Halliburton or Okoro or anyone else that you kind of have in that sort of that late tens to teens range?
I would have a hard time justifying not taking him just because of who else is going to be around there. I mean, if picking there, and obviously we know that there's going to be some changes to how the board plays out based on where the guys who, you know, I've rated so low that are clearly going to go in the top 10 go, you know, is Toppin off the board at 8? Is Wiseman off the board at 8? Does that mean that a Kongwu is off the board at 8? You know, I have a very hard time justifying taking any of the guards that are in that range over him, just because I don't think there's anybody who is a clear fit next to Sexton and Garland, you know, that you can justify taking there. I would rather take Vassell than Isaac Okoro, obviously because I have him ranked higher than Okoro now. And particularly for the Cavs, it's just a beautiful fit. Chetty is going to be so happy that he doesn't have to play a minute of four in 2020, 2021 if they take Devin Vassell. That's like the immediate thing that I point to is like, yes, this is why this guy fits here, is just because he's going to be able to play up a position if somebody gets hurt. You know, he's the guy who is going to probably be on a timeshare with Osman as a rookie, and that's kind of where his fit is going to go, is like, if you take Vassell at like 8, you're kind of planning to fit him in to kind of maybe eventually replace Osman in the starting lineup, or at least be able to kind of share time in certain matchups. You can kind of split them in the starting lineup. And then he's the guy that you shift to, you know, when Kevin Love misses his customary 20 games or whatever, in for minutes at the four in the rotation that they've been desperately struggling to fill in the 2 years since LeBron left.
All right, Trevor, we'll wrap up on this, the aforementioned promise bit. Why is James Wiseman the reincarnation of Chris Bosh?
I This is the thing that is so annoying is you get people that are either college basketball guys or are kind of like, you know, commentator NBA adjacent who aren't, you know, your more knowledgeable guys. And, you know, these comparisons get made and there's really no, it, like, they never get pressed on it. Like, Jay Billis can say that James Wiseman looks like Chris Bosh, but there's no justification for that given. You know, there's no follow-up to kind of test him on that. I mean, Wiseman is 2 inches bigger than Chris Bosh. He's got, I think, 4 inches on his wingspan. He is certainly not the basketball awareness IQ guy that Bosh was. Bosh is one of the top, probably top 10 guys of the last decade.
His defense and like his ability to adjust on those LeBron Heat teams is one of the most underrated things in modern basketball, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like Bosh is a switch defender and Wiseman is like a traditional rim protector. Like, there's no way around that. Wiseman is so much better as a rebounder because he's so much bigger. He's so much better as a rim roller, again, because he's so much bigger. And, you know, Bosh was really, really good as a post player in a way that Wiseman probably isn't going to be because he's so agile. He was so much better as a shooter because he was so agile and had guard skills. You know, it's just – like, more than anything, like, I have always been the guy who gets so angry at these draft comparisons that are so lazy. Because, you know, every year you've got the next Kristaps Porzingis or the next Dirk Nowitzki, whichever, you know, big white shooting big there is. You've got your next – or you can pick your next point guard based on whoever plays like who's ever in the league. You know, everybody's searching for the next of whatever's been successful. But this is the first one that we've had in a long time that just, like, is completely out of left field that just makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, I can't think of many bigs who have been good in the league in the last decade who are so much more different than James Wiseman than Chris Bosh. There's so many better fits that you can pick. It's just like, I don't understand how you get there. Like, looking at those two guys just physically, like, how does that comparison come up?
Yeah, I hope you didn't pop a blood vessel. But Trevor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and talking about the draft. Find him on Twitter at Illegal Screens, and he'll be back on, I'm sure, soon before we get to the draft again. But Trevor, as always, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, Chris Manning here for one last thing. If you haven't checked it out already, be sure to check out the newest podcast in the Locked On Network, Chad Ford's NBA Big Board. He's had great episodes with people like Mark Stein and John Hollinger breaking down the NBA draft, and Chad Ford is back, and you're going to want to check out his podcast. That's it, the newest podcast in the Locked On Podcast Network, Chad Ford's NBA Big Board. Find that wherever you are listening to podcasts.